Welcome to the Career Insights Podcast, presented by ABA Legal Career Central. On today's podcast, we conclude our discussion on character and fitness in the legal profession. If you missed part one, you may want to pause and check that out first. On that episode of Career Insights, we discussed what the character and fitness prerequisite for admission to the practice of law is, what it means to be a good lawyer, the characteristics they should have, and how to develop them. Now we pick up with Derek Davis, Executive Director of the Harvard Law School Center on the Legal Profession.
Let me ask, you touched on this earlier, but let me rephrase the question in this next question. We know that character and fitness is important at the outset, at the entry level to the bar. But what can we do as a profession, both from a regulatory standpoint, what can state boards of bar overseers and the state judiciaries do better to not only police, but support better character? So we have legal assistance programs, we have all these nice things in some states, but is there something else we could be doing?
So I do want to just pause to commend the judiciary and the bars for taking more affirmative actions than certainly were the case when I was a young lawyer many years ago, and particularly around things like substance abuse, which we know is a huge problem in the legal population, and frankly, one in which, you know, is probably on the increase because of the stress around the practice of law, which, you know, practice of law has gotten more stressful at every level of the profession than it was before. It was always there. I'm just saying it's probably even worse. And to have, whether these are hotlines or referral programs, and what I suggest is we try to make these available not just to people who've gotten themselves in trouble, but before as a resource. And this is a big issue in our country, as we know, for mental health generally and substance abuse generally. The problem is that there are insufficient resources, and they're not even to treat the people who have already gotten in trouble, let alone for people who want to, who see themselves in a downward spiral and want help. And so I hope that, you know, we try to expand these programs as much as possible, again, to go beyond substance abuse to depression and to wider mental health issues. So that's, I think we've moved a long way, but we have a long way to go. Again, maybe because I see this issue in a broader context even than that, I think what we ought to be doing is looking for ways for lawyers in their careers to continue to be engaged with each other around thinking through what good character is and how to support it. So take institutions like law firms or in-house legal departments or government law offices or public interest organizations. One thing that's changed pretty dramatically in the legal profession over, let's say, the last half century, is law has gone from primarily being practiced by solo practitioners and people in very small law firms to more and more lawyers practicing in institutions of larger and larger size. So, you know, when I was a law student, a big law firm had 250 lawyers. Now it has 2,500 lawyers or 3,000 lawyers. A government law office might have had 100 lawyers. Now it might have 1,000 lawyers. In-house legal departments have mushroomed. Law clinics, even public interest organizations. There are still many solo practitioners, and I want to come back to them in a second. But more and more, lawyers are practicing in an institutional setting. Those institutions have an obligation to help to support good character and professionalism within the lawyers who practice there. That means training and mentoring. That means providing opportunities for lawyers to raise questions, to ask for help. It means modeling by the most senior people of the behavior and the virtues that we want the junior people to have. The problem is that as those institutions get bigger and as the law practice gets more competitive, that the time and the resources for that kind of training and development are frankly less there than they once were. I mean, if you ask most lawyers, how did you learn to be a good lawyer? How did you learn to be a professional? It wasn't studying for the bar exam. It wasn't in law school. It was sitting at the bedside, a senior lawyer, going over a document, or it was listening to a lawyer on a phone tell a client, you know, I understand why you want to do that, but you can't do it. Here's a different way that you might be able to accomplish the same result. But we know that that kind of mentoring and training and development, let's put it this way, is certainly under pressure. So how do we reinvigorate that? How do we get senior lawyers to understand that that's a professional responsibility they have? How do we also institutionalize it? So, you know, how do we create more formal training and development opportunities? How do we make sure that those opportunities are equally spread among an increasingly diverse population? You know, Derek, both of you and I have spent a lot of our time thinking about diversity and inclusion in this profession. And one of the biggest complaints that people of color and women have is that they're not getting access to that same kind of, you know, informal socialization and professional development as maybe some of their white male peers. And as I've said, it's harder for everybody to get it in a world in which the leverage ratio, just to keep a private law firm in mind, has gone from 1 to 1 to 1 to 2 to 1 to 5 or whatever it now is. And partners are busier and busier. We could tell this same story in lots of other settings. You know, it's even perhaps harder in government law offices and public defender services and state prosecutor's offices, where people are really strapped with budget cuts and caseloads are exploding. Very hard to get that kind of informal socialization. So how do we begin to recreate it? Well, one thing, again, and I give the bar credit, this idea of continuing legal education and some ways in which we try to engage lawyers throughout their careers is a good one, but it's only a good one if it's well executed. And we all know that a lot of continuing legal education, people come in, they sign their names, and then they either leave or they spend their whole time on their crackberries or other kind of devices. And, you know, and that to the extent they're picking up anything, they're picking up, you know, formal new legal rules. They're not picking up what does it mean to be a good lawyer. Used to be bar associations were where a lot of this happened. But we know bar association memberships are declining, and that, you know, bars are becoming bigger and bigger. It's harder to get that kind of personal attention and time of senior lawyers. We've created executive education programs here at Harvard Law School. It's one of the things I'm proud of to say that I was instrumental in creating here at Harvard. And we teach courses called Leadership in Law Firms and Leadership in Corporate Counsel. We teach courses for younger lawyers. We've done some things around diversity with the Leadership Council on Legal Diversity and the ABA president. We did something around gender. And these things are helpful, and we try to focus attention not just on strategy or just on, you know, legal skills, but to focus attention on what does it mean to be a good lawyer? How do you become a good leader? How do you listen to your clients? How do you develop and mentor young professionals? But it's just a start. And I think that's a critical challenge that we are facing in our profession today, and you know, we can begin to see some of the results of it by the number of people who are dropping out of the profession, by the levels of unhappiness in the profession, you know, by quite frankly some of the kinds of misconduct that we see in the profession.
So that leads very nicely to the next question. In the last several decades, certainly in the last two decades, we've seen the headlines of lawyer misconduct. We've seen a lot of incidents where lawyers have been asked to step down from high-profile positions. In your view, has something fundamentally changed about the legal profession in producing these kinds of incidents? Or do we simply just have more access to information as the media playing up something that has always been there and it's just now more noticeable?
So, Derek, as another great question, I think I'll have to take the typical law professor's answer and say it's both, right? That is unquestionably part of what's happening is just there's a much bigger spotlight focused on the legal profession and all aspects of the legal profession. I mean, you know, there used to be virtually no information about lawyers. Even lawyer misconduct was confidential. You know, that the most common, I once wrote a long article many years ago called Who Should Regulate Lawyers? And, you know, if you go back to the 1970s or the 1960s, most bar discipline was private and confidential. The most common sanction was a private letter of reprimand. Okay, well, even if it was happening, nobody would know about it, right? It was only in the most high-profile cases that it was public at all. And again, I understand there were reasons for that, confidentiality, false charges. But the fact of the matter is, I think we all know that there was a lot of misconduct that either went unreported or even if it was reported, nobody knew about it. It was hard to get a lawyer to sue another lawyer for malpractice. Again, it was kind of a professional brotherhood. There was a code of silence among lawyers. It's not just lawyers. We know this is true with doctors and police officers and, you know, university professors. There was a lot of silence. And the victims often felt powerless to confront that code of silence and the authority that it represented. And, you know, we are now witnessing the explosion in the Me Too movement and allegations of sexual harassment and gender discrimination and worse. And we know that many of these incidences go back many, many years. But the women felt that they had to remain silent because otherwise they would ruin their careers or no one would believe them. So that's clearly a big part of the problem. And now we have a 24/7, 365, 8 billion channel spectrum news cycle that has to be fed. And scandal is, you know, one of the biggest things that sells, and scandal directed at high-profile people sells even more. So, you know, you put all those things together, yes, you're going to get much more reporting and attention for good reasons and for maybe some bad reasons. Having said that, I think the pressures are greater today on lawyers than they were in the past. I think the pressures on lawyers to bill hours, to generate revenue, to keep up with their friends in investment banking and hedge funds, to do what clients say and want. You know, the clients are more sophisticated. The clients are much more likely lawyer A doesn't do what they want to go to lawyer B. The lawyer may feel that if the client goes to lawyer B, that this is going to have an effect on my compensation this year, that, or worse yet, that I'll be asked to leave, you know, and there's a little bit more of an ethos today that, well, come on, anything goes, everybody would do it. You know, the smartest guys in the room are the ones who push the boundaries out the most, right? That's the title of the book about the McKinsey consultants for Enron who ended up, you know, in the crisis before the crisis before the crisis before the last one, right. You know, almost crashing the global economy. But we can see the same thing that was being done with very, very risky, high-level double backflip derivatives and other kinds of financial products that were being blessed by many lawyers as a way of generating huge amounts of business required to pay lawyers and the salaries that they're being paid now. So I'm saying just that, you know, the pressures are more. I mean, again, one always has to be careful about looking back with nostalgia in the past. Lawyers led a very insulated life in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And people, you could celebrate that as being separated from commercial values. It was much easier to show integrity and professionalism. But it's also the case that they excluded pretty much 50% of the population, that's called women, and then another 20% of the population called people of color, and, you know, actually even Jewish lawyers, right, and Catholic lawyers, right, and, you know, so there was a way in which that world was insulated, in part because of exclusionary boundaries, and in part because, quite frankly, the clients didn't really know much about what the lawyers were doing, and the lawyers could pretty much do whatever they wanted. That, there was a lot that wasn't good about that world, but now that we have much more openness and transparency and more, though certainly not complete, diversity, how are we also going to protect the character of lawyers from becoming overrun by the commercialism of the world? It's not that law and business were ever totally separate things. As somebody I once interviewed said, you know, if you get paid for doing something and you get paid for, that's a business, okay? On the other hand, they can't just be the same thing, because we depend on lawyers to uphold the system and the rules of the road and the fundamental values within which the market needs in order to survive and thrive. So how do we do that? I've been saying for years that what we need is a kind of market professionalism,
yeah,
that's not defined as the opposite of the market, but that isn't just the market, right, either. And I think that's our challenge.
One of my former partners said, we're not only the players, we're the referees.
That's a great way to put it.
So I'm going to combine these last two questions, because I think you've touched on them before, but it sort of wraps up nicely our discussion today. As we look forward to the future as a profession, how do you see these questions of character and fitness, as well as the broader conceptions of professionalism, evolving? And is there a distinction? Is there a distinction between character and fitness? And as we move forward, is it really? Are we really talking about professionalism?
You know, Derek, I think in many ways all of these words, professionalism, character, fitness, ethics, are getting at a common thing. You know, I spent a year at the Safra Center here on what used to be called the Center on Ethics of the Professions, and I spent a lot of time with philosophers who spend their entire life telling you the difference between morality and ethics and professionalism. And you know, I'm not as smart as they are, so I'm not going to dispute that there are lots of differences. But I think at a common sense level, we know that there's something common that they're trying to get at, and that, yes, it is both evolving and yet has to have some core things that remain the same. As you know, Derek, another of our big projects is we're doing work on, quote, disruptive innovation in the market for legal services, and we're looking at technology and new organizational forms and new competition and globalization and how all these things are transforming the legal profession. But, you know, I've been giving a talk lately, and I talk about those things, but I say that way of looking at things is both under and over-inclusive. It's under-inclusive because it acts as though what's happening to the legal profession is unique to the legal profession, when in fact, all of these things are reshaping everything about our world. Of course they're going to reshape law. Law is, as I often say, a lagging, not a leading indicator of change, meaning it follows along with these broader changes. But on the other hand, it's this way of thinking about things is over-inclusive because it acts as if everything will or should change. But if everything were to change, what does it mean to have the rule of law, which requires a kind of continuity, predictability, a set of core values? Or what does it mean to develop the character of a good lawyer, where that implies something that's developed over time, mm-hmm. that people make long-term investments in, that can't just simply be disrupted at the drop of a hat or the latest whim? So it's about continuity and change, and how do we navigate these intertwined forces as we move into the new world? We cannot just, you know, like my son used to do when he was 2 years old, you know, bang on the table and say, I wish it was just the way it was. Or I still sometimes, now he's a teenager, I say, just do it the way I did it. Doesn't work that way.
Doesn't work that way.
No, doesn't work that way. On the other hand, I'm trying to impart to my son some core values about what it means to be a good person, that when he says, yeah, well, that's just the way it was in the 50s, I said, yeah, and it was that way in the 1850s and the 1750s, it's going to be that way in the 2550s, okay? There's something there, and I think we all know it, but it's how to identify it in a meaningful way that my students and the lawyers listening to this podcast can identify with and feel has real content and meaning, while still understanding that it has to evolve over time to adapt to changes in circumstances. Now, that sounds like a pretty tall order, except for, isn't that what our constitutional democracy has been founded on? Okay.
That's right.
Isn't that what we've been doing in this country for the last 200 plus years? I'm not perfectly, with lots of problems, lots of fits and starts. But if we were to begin to approach the idea of character and fitness that way, as a kind of evolving understanding of the core values and commitments that make us lawyers
better,
and that make us proud to be lawyers, and to encourage our children to be lawyers if they want, or to encourage people to use lawyers and to feel that they are responsible and helpful and important members of society, if we think about it that way, then I guess I'm confident that we can do at least as good a job as we've been doing in understanding our constitutional values for the last 200 plus years.
Well, Professor Wilkins, we can't thank you enough for your time and your insights today. I'm sure that our listeners appreciated your thoughts on this critical issue. We look forward to your continued research on this issue and the other subject areas that the Center on the Legal Profession covers. If you'd like to learn more about the character and fitness in the legal profession, please check out this month's issue on the Center on the Legal Profession's digital magazine's The Practice website, which you can access by visiting the CLP Center here at Harvard. But again, on behalf of the ABA Legal Career Central website, Professor Wilkins, thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, Derek. This has really been enjoyable, and thank you to the listeners for listening. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Career Insights podcast from ABA Legal Career Central.